On this week's episode of Conversations, hosted by Sarah Mason for the HMC Network, our guest is Josh Mankiewicz, correspondent for Dateline NBC. Mankiewicz has covered a wide range of stories, including politics, for KCAL-TV Los Angeles, WCBS-TV New York, and WJLA-TV Washington, D.C. He served as a correspondent for Fox Broadcasting Company and ABC News. Based in Los Angeles, Mankiewicz is celebrating 25 years with Dateline. Hello, everyone. This is Sarah Mason from the HMC Network, and this is an episode of Conversations with Cooler People Than Me. And I'm sitting here with Josh Mankiewicz, who is a reporter for Dateline NBC, rock star reporter. It is his 25th anniversary as of Groundhog Day this year, 2020.
Hard to believe.
That's incredible, really, when you think about it.
And it went by like that.
Did it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, it doesn't seem like it's been 25 years since 1995, but it has.
And the show began in 92?
Yeah, I joined a couple of years after it began. We were a different broadcast back then.
How so?
We did four or five unrelated stories every night. And they were about all kinds of different things. We were sort of the cooler 60 Minutes. You know, it was faster paced. There was better production. The stories were a little more topical. And that was Dateline for a number of years. And sometimes, you know, I was doing some investigative stories and some celebrity profiles and stuff about how to raise your kids. And I remember doing stories about how commercials are made, all kinds of things. And then in about, 2006 or 2007, we started doing all true crime.
It wasn't until then. Interesting.
It's not like we weren't doing any true crime. You know, we covered OJ right from the beginning, which was sort of, you know, sparked the whole interest in true crime. And then we also did Casey Anthony, I think before we were doing all true crime hours. But definitely at some point we became, you know, what we now talk about in the ads. We describe Dateline as being the true crime original. Also, at some point we changed our name from Dateline NBC to just Dateline. Mm. So now we're just Dateline. And the broadcast began focusing primarily on murders, and not just murders, but the sort of relationships that lead up to that. I mean, we could find bloodier crimes. We could find more famous crimes. But we're not as interested in that. We don't do stories about, most of the time we don't do stories about sex crimes. Most of the time we don't do stories in which kids are the victims, because it's a tough story to tell and people just want to change the channel if it's too difficult. And again, it's not about finding the most shocking crime or the most outrageous crime. It's about a crime that tells you something about the people involved. Because most of what we're doing are stories about murders that began as relationships that went wrong. Most people in your audience will never be the victim of a violent crime. I mean, I hope none of them are. Most people are not. But everybody's been in a relationship that didn't end the way they wanted it to.
True.
And this is our Dateline, you know, has become about, among other things, the choices some people make when relationships don't work out.
Is that why you guys are rock stars, you think? Because is that what the connection is? Because, I mean, you go to Crime Con, which I've been when you guys haven't been, but that I know there's a frenzy around you guys there now.
Crime Con, you're talking about the annual convention of true crime enthusiasts.
Yes. It's like Comic-Con for
tickets available at crimecon.com. That one?
Yes.
Yeah. First of all, we have no part in CrimeCon. I mean, we don't have any financial stake in it. It's independent from
us.
But
you're the headliners.
Well, because we are the true crime original, because we do this better than anybody else does it, and because we've been doing it for such a long time. I was astonished when I went to the first CrimeCon in Indianapolis about 3 years ago, and I came home and said to I made a speech, and there were 1,500 people there, and they were all, they'd seen every episode of Dateline and were ready to talk about it. And since then, it's grown to, I don't know, I'm going to say 3 to 4 times that size. And the last episode was in New Orleans, and it just packed a hall there. And I remember going home after the first one and saying to my my boss, executive producer of Dateline, Liz Cole, you got to go. We've all got to go next time. We've all got to be there. This is not like, I mean, this is not like some Venn diagram that overlaps with our audience. This is the audience.
This is your target audience.
And so we go, and people ask us, these are serious fans, and they are by and large all serious people. It's not like they're showing up in costume or something. I mean, these are people who have watched all the episodes and have a lot of interesting things to say about the criminal justice system, about law enforcement, about relationships between men and women, about domestic violence, about people's rights, about the way crimes are investigated. And they want to talk about that. They want to talk about all of that. And they'll say to you, what happened in the mystery on Albion Road? And I'm like, which one is that? Because I don't write the titles.
That's fandom right there.
Oh, yeah.
They know more than.
Oh, no. They know the titles. And I don't know all the titles because I don't. The correspondents, we don't write those.
Okay.
We're generally responsible for the internal content of the story, but maybe not what it's called. And so then people explain, oh, no, this was the one with this guy and this guy. And they give you some details of the story. I'm like, oh, yeah, well. And then you have to tell them, like, what happened? They're still locked up or they're getting a new trial or whatever. Yeah. People are pretty interested.
Yeah. Well, I want to get back to that later on, but I want to talk a little bit about your family. For those of you listening who don't know, Josh's family is extraordinary royalty in show business and politics and journalism. Your grandfather Herman wrote Citizen Kane.
He did.
David Fincher's making a movie about him called Mank with Gary Oldman,
which is coming out later this year.
And it'll be on Netflix. It is currently filming, I believe.
I think that's right.
And I mean, it really, it kind of talks about the controversy over him really being the one who wrote it and how difficult it was to work with Orson Welles.
Well, Orson Welles, in addition to being super talented, was also a gigantic egotist. But it was Herman who knew William Randolph Hearst. Welles didn't know him. Herman had been to San Simeon and had seen all of that side of Hearst. Welles had not. Herman was had been a production line writer for a lot of studios. And so he was his personal knowledge of Hearst definitely came into play when he was writing the screenplay. So I don't have any inside line on what Fincher's movie's about. We're not part of that in any way. It's based on a book that was written
by his father.
No, the script is written by Fincher's father. The book, which was called Mank, is written by a Time Life writer, a guy named Dick Merriman. I think the book came out, in the late 70s or early 80s, but it's called Mank.
Yeah.
We cooperated with that book as a family. I personally never met Herman, so I wasn't part of any of that. But I know my dad and others in the family definitely cooperated on that. And, I thought what emerged was in that book was sort of, again, I didn't know him, but what emerged was a portrait of the guy that I'd always been told about. Mm-hmm. He was funny. He was smart. He was gifted. He was his own worst enemy. He hated himself. He felt guilty for going to Hollywood and cashing in and leaving New York City behind, where he worked for the New Yorker and the New York Times. He was a drama critic of the Times, and he was a playwright, and he saw Hollywood as being a place for people with small intellects to make large amounts of money. And he felt like a big sellout. He also drank himself to death and gambled away a colossal amount of money that he made in movies. So I thought that's certainly grist for a great dramatic film about somebody. So I hope that emerges, and I'm sure it does, because this screenplay is basically based on that book.
And Fincher's father, Jack, wrote several biographies. He wrote one on Howard Hughes, which didn't end up as the subject for The Aviator. But He seemed to have a fascination with your grandfather, so I think it will be interesting.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I mean, he was a fascinating guy. I've seen some photographs of Gary Oldman on the set.
Does he look like him?
Dressed up like Herman. He really does.
Wow.
It's really weird. Yeah. 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 Because in real life, he does not look like Herman, but he sure does in this movie.
Well, he didn't look like Churchill either. Yeah. Your uncle, Joseph, your great uncle, won 4 Oscars.
Yes.
2 for All About Eve, which is one of my favorite all-time movies.
Mine
for
too.
Writing and directing. He did Cleopatra. Your father, Frank, was Bobby Kennedy's press secretary.
Yep.
He also was an entertainment lawyer, repped Steve McQueen and James Mason and everyone, you know, Tonto.
Jay Silverheels. Yeah. Jay Silverheels came over to our house once to sign some stuff. This is when my dad was an entertainment attorney in Beverly Hills in the late 50s. And Jay Silverheels played Tonto on The Lone Ranger. And he came over to the house once to sign some papers or something. And he came straight from the set. So he was still wearing that jacket with the fringe on it. And I was transfixed in the living room. I remember thinking, like, Tonto, who's usually on the TV set, is now next to the TV set.
That's so cool.
I could not get over that. I remember him saying hello to me. And I don't think I could get a word out. I was so shy.
And you lived in Peru for a little while your father was working for the Peace Corps, right?
Well, my dad eventually decided that if he stayed on as a Hollywood entertainment attorney, he would make a ton of money, but he would have left no mark on the world. And so he quit what I think was going to be an extremely lucrative career and wrote to President Kennedy, who had just come into office, and asked for a job. And off we went to Peru for a couple of years. My dad was country director of the Peace Corps. My dad had learned to speak Spanish in the Army in World War II.
So he was in the Battle of the Bulge.
He was in the 69th Infantry. He won a Bronze Star for something, which he would never talk to us about, by the way. He did learn Spanish in the Army, and we went to Peru for a couple of years, which was quite eye-opening if you'd grown up in Los Angeles in the late 50s. You know, you were not seeing homeless people where we lived, stacked up on the sidewalk like cordwood, kind of like you do now in Los Angeles, anywhere you look. But back then, no. And it was eye opening, and I learned to speak some Spanish, and I saw the United States differently and the world differently. And then,
how old were you?
I was 7 when I got there, and almost 9 when I left.
So would you say that experience had something to do with your interest in going into journalism?
Maybe. I mean, my interest in journalism sort of grew from, you know, my dad was kind of on the front lines of news making, certainly in the 60s. You know, he worked for Bobby and he ran the McGovern campaign in 72. But I was already pretty interested in journalism before that, just because we watched the news every night during dinner. We watched most often the Cronkite news at 7 o'clock. And so I saw Vietnam and the civil rights movement and later Watergate played out at dinner time every day. And then after we had silently watched the news, then we would have a discussion about what was on the news. And that happened every night. I had dinner with my parents growing up. And that definitely got me interested in public affairs. But it also got me interested in journalism because I remember watching the correspondence on the news. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, that guy was in Atlanta on Monday. And now he's in Jacksonville on Wednesday. And now it's Friday. And he's in Tallahassee. And he's doing 3 different stories. I remember thinking, that guy has an interesting job.
Mm-hmm. And you lived in D.C. or you grew up in D.C. mostly, right?
Mostly I did. I mean, I was born out here in California. And then we went to Peru when Dad decided to make this big career change. And then we went to D.C. So by the time I was 9 years old, I was in D.C. And I lived there all through college, all through my first couple of jobs. Mm-hmm. And I didn't leave D.C. until I was in my mid-20s.
And your brother, Ben Mankiewicz, is the host of Turner Classic Movies.
He is.
So he kind of went the Hollywood route and you went the journalism route.
He was a journalist before he worked at TCM. In fact, every other job he ever had before he went to TCM was in journalism. My brother went to Columbia Journalism School like my dad did. I did not.
You went to Haverford?
I went to Haverford, and then I already had a job at ABC News working on the assignment desk when I graduated. So I just went to that and I didn't go to grad school. But Ben went to Columbia Journalism School, and then he was a sports producer in DC, and he worked in sports talk radio in DC. And then he was a reporter in Charleston, South Carolina, and then Miami, and then came to LA, and then went to Turner Classic Movies. So he did definitely have a background in journalism.
Your father was also the president of NPR at a real critical time. He really kind of expanded and made it what it is today.
Created Morning Edition.
Yeah.
There was no morning show before.
That's incredible. Yeah. I mean, I grew up listening to that. My mother had it on every single morning.
Had to persuade Bob Edwards to come off All Things Considered and do the morning show.
Really?
Yeah. And then it ended up being like the greatest thing for him.
Yeah. What a legacy. I mean, these examples of your family members just scratch the surface. I mean, you've got a huge.
Yeah, they're a successful bunch. I mean, my dad's brother wrote a bunch of novels, wrote a bunch of screenplays, worked on a bunch of TV shows. Joe's sons, Tom and Chris, producing in Hollywood, and Tom also a writer, wrote a bunch of the Superman movies, wrote a bunch of the Bond films. Mm. My cousin John worked on House of Cards, worked on Miami Vice, worked on Bosch on Amazon Prime, and now has a series called Interrogation that's about to start on CBS All Access, which looks great, I gotta say.
So what was it? What did that, the shadows of these folks loom large in your house growing up? I mean, how was it, you know, sitting next to some of these really famous people that you got to meet?
Well, first of all, I mean, it was just life. I mean, we lived very modestly. You know, we had one car until, I don't know, I was in like high school. Mm. I mean, my dad took the city bus to work every day. We rented our house until I was in high school, I think. We didn't own any place. You know, my dad was in public service a lot of that time. So I didn't really feel like I was, you know, living some upper crust existence. We had George Cukor at the dinner table sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we had Dolores Huerta, you know, plotting strategy with my dad at the kitchen table a few times.
Wow.
But these were just people that came over and, you know, I said hi to them and then I went to do whatever I was doing. There wasn't any sense that we were, you know, I now wish, of course, I'd paid more attention to both George and Dolores, you know, but that's all these years later.
So you started your TV reporting career at ABC, and I think I understand that Carl Bernstein is the one who first break.
Carl was instrumental in my career. I started working at ABC News in the summer of 1975 as a part-time desk assistant on the assignment desk. And I worked there that summer, working in the middle of the night. And I remember once I delivered Sam Donaldson his suit from the cleaners. And he said, "Hi, Josh," or "Thanks, Josh," which was a big moment because it was widely believed at ABC that you did not exist until Sam learned your name.
Oh.
And then I worked there in the summer of 75 and 76. And then summer 77, I graduated from college and I went back there first briefly with Good Morning America. But then I got this incredible job where I went to Capitol Hill as the off-air reporter and I covered the Congress for 3 years. With Britt Hume, who was the on-air reporter back then. And that was fascinating. And it you know, because I'd kind of grown up around politics, so it was a terrific job. And working in the U.S., covering the U.S. House every day was a lot of fun.
You think it would be that fun today?
Yeah, it would be. Because,
it'd be different.
Well, it's different in that you probably, I mean, I haven't covered Congress in a while, but I know you don't have the same kind of access to the members that you did then. You used to be able to just run down and grab them off the floor and ask them a question. And it was much more relaxed in the Senate. Now, I'm sure both because of security concerns and the fact that most of those people don't want reporters anywhere near them, you don't have the same kind of access. At the time, it was much easier to ask the people you were covering a question. That's a big issue now at all levels of government. When I was covering politics in New York City, you could ask Ed Koch, who was mayor of New York, a question pretty much anytime you wanted. He enjoyed the verbal give and take with the press. He understood local television in a way that most local television executives don't understand local television. And he was great copy all the time. He was also quite willing, as a lot of politicians are not, to defend things he'd done, choices he'd made, projects he'd backed, projects he hadn't backed, insults he'd given. Mm-hmm. He was ready to go back and forth. Nobody wants to do that anymore. And so the sort of White House model in which reporters are essentially isolated from the person that they're covering and they are spoon-fed little bits of news at staged gatherings or the occasional chopper side press conference, that's becoming the model for government and the press at almost all levels. And that's a big problem because that results in less access, less freedom of the press, and less knowledge by the public of what these people are actually up to. But anyway, when I covered politics, when I covered Congress, it wasn't like that. You could really get these guys on the record anytime you wanted. And they didn't flinch if you walked up to them when they were sunning themselves on the steps of the Capitol. You could ask them how they were going to vote on this bill or that bill. And so as a result, you sort of get to know some of these people. Anyway, after I'd been there a while, Carl Bernstein, who'd been hired by Rune Arledge off the Washington Post to be the Washington bureau chief of ABC News, a job in which Carl was spectacularly miscast.
Really?
He was a reporter, not a news manager. Mm-hmm. Carl got it in his head that I should be trained to be a TV reporter. And so which I wasn't even sure I wanted to do at that point, but Carl thought this was a great idea. And he sent me to the Washington station of ABC News, the local affiliate, so that he could watch me. Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, you didn't start your broadcasting career in the eighth largest market in the country.
Right.
That just didn't happen. Nobody did that. And so this was a way of cutting a lot of years off the process. But I also wasn't in any way sort of up to the skill level of other people at that affiliate. So I had to work pretty hard, and I did. And it was that was a great job. And it was good because it was in D.C. Mm-hmm. where I'd lived for a long time. So I kind of knew my way around town. And I knew, who was on the city council and who had been on the city council before. I knew a little bit of the backstory of what was going on and who hated who and who didn't. So I did that for not quite a year and a half. And I should have stuck with it longer because it was a good job. And I worked for a guy named Dow Smith, who was very, very smart and kind of one of the maybe unsung heroes of my career, who really helped me a lot and had great advice. And then ABC took me back as a correspondent. And I was an ABC News correspondent for 4 years, during which time I mostly didn't get on the air very much. I was just kind of like hanging around the periphery. I covered the Mondale campaign in 84, and I did a lot of Good Morning America back at a time when Good Morning America was the throwaway show, when morning news shows didn't count, and it was all about the evening news. That's not the case anymore. But I did a lot of that, and I did a lot of radio, which was good because it teaches you to write well and quickly. But I was hardly ever on the evening news, and I was hardly ever on I was never on 2020. I think I was on Nightline a few times and on the evening news. I don't know, probably 15 times in 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then I quit and went back to local TV where I had a lot more fun.
Where was that?
That was at WCBS in New York.
Oh, okay.
So and I covered Long Island for a couple of years, and then I became the political reporter.
So is that where Dateline came about from being at NBC?
Yeah. I mean, I was working at the CBS station in New York, and I did politics there for a while. And then I came out here to California and I was the political reporter for KCAL for Channel 9, which was then not co-owned by CBS the way it is now. Mm-hmm. It was a separate independent station owned by the Disney Corporation. And I worked there for a couple of years. Then I went to a news magazine that Fox did that didn't last called Front Page. Ron Reagan was on the show with me. A very good guy. And I did that it only lasted about a year. And I did that, and then I kind of sat around for a year waiting for that contract to end. And then I went to Dateline, and that was 25 years ago.
Wow. And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
Conversations, hosted by Sarah Mason, is brought to you by the HMC Network. For over 10 years, the HMC has been producing award-winning popular podcasts, digital content, and events. Visit the HMCnetwork.com. You did a lot of coverage of Michael Jackson.
I did.
And I'm curious if you think that he would be convicted today.
Well, I think he would be. In part because, you know, the public at large is a lot more willing to believe bad things about celebrities than they used to be. I mean, OJ also would be convicted almost instantly because juries take on faith now, as they didn't at the time. The DNA evidence is coin of the realm.
Right.
So I think convicting OJ would be much, much, much easier than it was back in
95. Even with the backdrop of the – you know, violence against African Americans by cops and in a lot of communities.
I mean, that was an issue then, and it would be an issue now. But DNA, I mean, all those CSI shows have sort of done.
Sure, we've had all that since then.
They've done prosecutors' jobs for them to the point where a lot of prosecutors that I talk with now on Dateline talk about something called the CSI effect, which is if you don't have some piece of gee whiz technology, if you don't have DNA, if you don't have some videotape that you've enhanced so you can read somebody's license plate, which like doesn't exist, if you don't have facial recognition technology allowing you to take a picture and immediately identify it with a person, I mean, I guess that's coming, but it's not really here yet.
Right.
Juries don't want to convict. They think like if you don't have DNA, then you don't really have a case, which is nuts because sometimes you know, cases, ironclad cases can be built and don't have anything to do with DNA.
Yeah.
But yes, I think Jackson would be convicted now.
You think he's
Well, let me say this. I don't know whether he would be convicted. I think it would be much easier for a conviction to be obtained against Michael Jackson and, and against OJ now than before, if only because we are now, there is no longer a belief that celebrities are somehow better than the rest of us. You know, the TMZs of the world have made everyone see that they're just as shallow and venal as anybody else.
That's true. I didn't think about it that way. I mean, I'd be curious too, just some of the old cases back in the 90s, like the Menendez brothers and Pamela Smart, and how those would have played out differently in different eras, you know.
Well, also, how would all that stuff play out in an age of social media? I mean, that's another huge consideration. I mean, that's a wild card now in every case, which is what's going to surface on social media? How's it going to drip into the trial if it does? Mm-hmm. How's it going to influence what happens? I mean, it's been a while since we've had a big national case, you know, like OJ or Jackson or Casey Anthony.
Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, and that's an example. You know, what he's reading, what he's wearing, he's using the walker, all that stuff is communicated instantly to people in real time. That didn't used to be the case. That used to be some color that you'd put in your newspaper story that people would read the next day.
You're pretty active on Twitter.
I am pretty active on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, Dateline is responsible for me being on Twitter. They sort of pushed me into doing it back in 2009 when I started because they want us all to be they want the correspondents to be live on Twitter when their story is airing. Mm-hmm. So every Friday, if I'm on that Friday, whoever it is that's on has to be available on Twitter to answer questions from the audience in real time. And I understand why they're doing that. And it's fun. But what I realized after I was already on Twitter was that first of all, it was a great source of information because you get access to stuff that you're probably not going to see everywhere else. And you meet the viewers, which is, I think, fascinating because you find out exactly what they're thinking. I mean, for a long time, the only way we knew what the viewers were thinking was by looking at the ratings. And we used to, you know, generally if the rating was good, then they liked it. If you got a bad rating, then they didn't like it. Well, that's not quite true because frequently the ratings have to do with like what's on opposite you or what's on before you or after you or before or after someone else. So you're missing a lot if you're just looking at the numbers and trying to guess what people think. But now you know exactly what they're thinking. And that's very interesting.
In real time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also rewards, Twitter also rewards speed and snark and humor, all of which I value.
What do you think the future of Dateline is with the kind of content explosion, but also the way people are absorbing it differently? So people aren't watching TV the same way they used to. And how is that, how is it going to affect you? You seem to be one of the bulletproof shows on network TV.
Well, I certainly hope that we remain bulletproof for years to come because I like working here. But, you know, you say people watch TV the way they used to. I don't know. First of all, I don't know what used to means. I mean, people now record Dateline. I talk to plenty of people who tell me they have 25 Datelines on their DVR and they just watch them whenever they're home. So that's not the way people, I mean, the way people used to is, I mean, I remember driving fast to get home in time to watch Dallas. And I remember, you know, growing up, I mean, if you didn't see this week's episode of, you know, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. because you were, you know, out at a party or something like that, then you didn't see it.
Right.
You weren't going to see it again. That's it. That's not true anymore.
Right.
And of course, now there's all this competition that makes, you know, the three networks look kind of, you know, stodgy and conservative by comparison to what's on cable. But there's still great stuff available on the major networks. I mean, you know, The Good Wife, which was a CBS show, which now has now morphed into The Good Fight on CBS All Access. I mean, that was great. I never missed a single episode. New Amsterdam on NBC is as good as anything on cable. So, I mean, there is still plenty of great stuff on the networks, despite the colossal competition. And, you know, Dateline, I mean, you know, it pays to be on the ground floor or something.
Mm.
You know, we sort of started doing this. You know, the Dateline template is one that a lot of other people have imitated, and a lot of other people continue to imitate.
Right.
And that's all good. I urge them to do that. But I'm glad that we're around and we've become kind of a brand. And that's because largely due to the people that you don't see on the air, the people behind the camera, our producers and our editors and our camera crews, those people. I mean, one of the reasons I've been here 25 years and one of the reasons I want to stay is in a very long TV career that I've now had 45 years. Those people are the best I've ever worked with.
Wow. I talk to younger viewers, I guess, and, you know, they all watch YouTube. They don't watch TV,
right,
but yet they do know Dateline. And that I find fascinating because, and that's sort of what I was getting with in terms of the changing way people observe content, is that younger millennials and younger, and maybe kind of younger Gen Xers, really don't watch TV the same way. But your brand, they're tuning in to that. And you think, what is that? Why is that?
I mean, look, I'm enormously thrilled that people of all ages seem to be watching Dateline. And I'm always like sort of astonished when I run across young people who've seen all the episodes, because there are a lot of people out there who have cut the cord and people who are watching in ways that are completely non-traditional. Like,
right,
they're watching it on our website, or they're watching it on YouTube, or they're watching it in ways that I, at my age, aren't even familiar with, which I'm sure is also true. But clearly there's also a lot of people watching just by like turning the television on and either watching it live or recording it. A lot of people record it Friday nights and watch it on the weekends. I know that because of the comments I get on Twitter. So, I mean, I think that we have become, you know, I don't know that there is appointment TV anymore, because now you record everything and time shift it, or you watch it online in some way whenever you feel like absorbing that content. Maybe you watch it on your phone or your iPad, or you know, on the back of your of the airplane seat in front of you.
Right.
I mean, there's a million ways to watch content now. So there may not be appointment TV, but there are still shows that you are connected to. And, you know, I think Dateline's one of them. And I hope we continue to be for a long time.
And it's the brand, it's the being there, like you said, getting there first.
And people like seeing the system work. You know, we live in
what do you mean by that?
We live in this world in which nothing works the way it's supposed to. I mean, certainly Washington hasn't worked the way it was supposed to for a long time. You know, there's too many kids in your child's school class. You know, there's too many cars ahead of you on the freeway. But for 1 or 2 hours a week, that lying, cheating, conniving scoundrel, husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend, gets what's coming to them.
Sometimes they don't.
That's true.
How do you feel about it when that happens?
What people want is an ending. I mean, it's one of the things that makes it so hard for us to do cold cases because, you know, you don't want a story that ends, so who killed Sarah Mason? Well, the trial's next year. Good night.
Yeah, right.
You know, you want Bill was convicted. He's doing life.
Right.
Good night. But even if the story ends, Bill was acquitted. And he's, you know, moved to Saskatchewan, right? I mean, whatever it is, you want to know. You want a finish line. And so that's one reason why we've had so much trouble doing cold cases, although we still try and do them in some ways. But people want to know an ending. The audience wants to know an ending. Also, just in terms of the way the criminal justice system works, we can't get the court file and the documents and the 911 call and the crime scene tape. I mean, the crime scene photos and the tape of the guy being interrogated and looking kind of squirrely, the exhibits in the case. You can't get those until there's a verdict. That's when all that becomes public record. And a lot of times prosecutors and investigators, homicide detectives, won't talk to you until the case is over because they don't want to screw it up. They don't want their words to be used against them in trial. So they wait until there's a verdict. So that's another reason why we have to wait till the end.
Right. Is there ever been a time where you felt uneasy going to interview someone in prison, perhaps?
I've interviewed a lot of people in prison. First of all, most of those guys that we interview who are the accused, they're all on their best behavior by the time they're sitting across from me. This is a conspiracy. It's not my fault. My ex-wife's family has persuaded the police to think of me as the suspect. They all have tunnel vision. I had nothing to do with it. I'm not that guy. That's 99 times out of 100 what they're saying. And so they're trying to prove that they're a wonderful guy, so they're not threatening to you. Also, they're almost all shackled when they're talking to you. If they've been locked up,
stage it and put clothes on them or something.
Well, that's a separate question, which I'll get to in a second.
Okay.
But most of the time, these guys are not any threat, in part because they're trying to argue that you have nothing to fear from them, that no one does, and also they're generally corrections officers or prison people in the room with you, maybe not on camera when you're doing the interview. So that's part of it. And then some people, you know, you're interviewing them behind glass sometimes. So there actually isn't any contact between the two of you. That's not the hard part of this job. The hard part is interviewing those families. They're going through hell, and it doesn't end when there's a conviction, and it doesn't end when there's when the verdict is read, and it doesn't end when that person is sentenced to life, or it doesn't end when that person is put to death. It just doesn't end. And they're telling you the worst things that ever happened. And it's one reason why we take this so seriously. Like, you know, there are parts of this that are like fun and amusing. You know, some of the storytelling is fun, but the story, what happened, that's not fun. That's not amusing. Mm-hmm. It's super serious, and it'll make you cry if you listen to it long enough. And I mean, that's the big challenge is talking to those families and not breaking down crying at the same time you're listening to them tell their story, because you have to maintain some emotional distance because you're an objective reporter. So you can't be weeping along with them. You also can't be saying, all right, come on, knock it off. I got a story to do here. So you got to find something in the middle. That's much more challenging than actually interviewing people who are locked up or incarcerated after a verdict. Now, as I talk about the story versus the storytelling, we have a lot more fun with the storytelling than we ever can have with the story itself. Mm-hmm. So when people are locked up, depending on the correctional institution, some are a little more forgiving than others. You can sometimes they'll let you dress the guy in the clothes that he wears when he goes to court. Like maybe if, you know, the trial's still going on or something like that, he'll have a wardrobe for court. Some people will let you put that stuff on them. I remember we did an interview with one guy in a who had been convicted and who was serving his sentence, and he was wearing an orange coverall, but the correctional facility allowed us to tell the guy to unbutton the top part of his coverall and pull it down to his waist. So now we're just seeing him from the waist up, and he's in a white T-shirt. And then we went to Banana Republic that morning and bought a dress shirt and put it on him over his white T-shirt. Then we put a couple of candles behind him, and he looks like he's in his den.
Yeah.
So then he's in every part of the story, telling the story of sort of leading up to the murder. Then he gets arrested. Then in the storyline, he gets convicted. And then all of a sudden, now we show him a somewhat wider shot. It's not just him and his nice new shirt and the candles behind him. You show him that he's wearing handcuffs and leg irons, which is that's a fun thing to do when we're telling a story.
What do they think about it?
Because it keeps the audience guessing. They're usually fine with that. Yeah. We don't make anybody do it.
Right.
I mean, if they don't want to do it, they don't have to do it. But generally people are okay with that.
How are these stories vetted?
You know, we find them all over the place. I mean, we read the papers in the country all over the country every day. And we've split up the country into different zones where, you know, somebody's responsible for reading all the newspapers in, you know, Florida, mm-hmm. you know, for example. And look, let's face it, without Florida and Texas, we'd be off the air. We would not have lasted 28 seasons. So we look in the papers for stories all the time. Police officers, prosecuting attorneys, defense attorneys, local stations all call us now that we've been around for so long. And they say, well, this thing just happened here in Kansas City.
Because you guys get there fast sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And you got to jump on it right away. Because although you frequently can't interview police and prosecutors until it's over, mm-hmm. you can collect all the stuff about the crime, you know, from the local news and the initial reports. And, you know, you can certainly talk to families early on, and you can talk to the family of the accused early on, and you can gather a lot of information early on. And then, of course, you have to wait for the trial and see what happens. And we do that. And so does the competition. I mean, frequently when we read about a story somewhere and make calls, somebody else is also calling.
Is there a story that sticks out to you over the 25 years?
Well, in 2017, I did a story about a friend of mine who was murdered. A guy named Steve Pitt, who was a forensic psychiatrist in Scottsdale, Arizona. And he was a big help to law enforcement. He did a lot of work for police departments around the country. And he was murdered by a guy that he'd done a court-ordered evaluation on several years earlier, like I think 8 to 10 years earlier. And this guy obviously didn't like the way that went. And he also didn't like the way a bunch of other things in his life had gone. He was a domestic abuser. He'd lost custody of his son, in part because of that and in part because of Steve's report on him. And he went to Steve's office, found him, murdered him as he was leaving work, then went to the lawyer that had represented his wife. Lawyer wasn't there, but he shot a couple of paralegals who had the bad luck to be working late that day, who had nothing to do with the case. Then went to the therapist's office where his son had been treated over the years, and he saw that person as having turned his son against him. That therapist wasn't there, but he rented office space to somebody else, or she rented office space to someone else, and the guy killed that person, who again didn't know him from Adam. And by then, police had figured out what connected these crime scenes. And as they closed in on him, he shot himself. And I went to Scottsdale to do a story about, I mean, to just, I went to Scottsdale to go to Steve's funeral. And I ended up staying there to do a story about this case and about sort of domestic violence from the inside, because we got a very powerful interview by the woman at the center of this, the ex-wife, who the guy had clearly been looking for. But because she had the wherewithal to hide herself and her son, she was not on his list of targets because she was at the time unfindable, but a bunch of other people weren't, and they're all dead.
Wow. Do you keep in touch with any of the detectives and people you meet along the way?
Sure. I mean, we go to a couple of events a year where there are homicide detectives. There's a thing in Las Vegas called CHIA, which is the California Homicide Investigators Association. And we go there and we meet detectives from, it's not just California because it's all over the sort of Western United States. These guys are very knowledgeable and they come in and they talk with us, and frequently we end up getting stories from there. But yeah, I end up staying, you know, in contact with a lot of the people we do stories with, not just the detectives, but also the prosecutors, with some of the defense attorneys, and with a lot of the victims. Hmm. I mean, when we started doing crime back in like 2006, 2007, 2008, the first one I did was the story of a woman in Reno, Nevada, who'd been murdered, named Brianna Dennison. And I originally didn't want to do these stories, but then I sort of saw, you know, when you start, you're traditionally on the police beat, you know, I didn't see myself going back there, but then I did this first one about Brianna, and, it definitely, I remember thinking afterwards, look, I mean, writing is writing and reporting is reporting. And so then I was kind of hooked. And I'm still in touch with her mom today. Oh. Yeah.
Is there a story you, or maybe is there an interview that's eluded you over the years that you'd like to do?
Oh, well, I mean, I would have loved to have spoken with Michael Jackson. You know, he avoided us.
Yeah. I bet he did.
The funny thing was, I will say this, it was amusing is the wrong word, but it was fascinating to see so many people say that, oh my gosh, they saw that documentary Leaving Neverland and say, wow, I had no idea. And I remember thinking, really? Because every single journalist who covered the Jackson case in 93 and then the later one in 2003, like, none of that came as a shock to any reporter who had covered that case. It was all abundantly clear from the beginning.
But like you said, you know, now the kind of, you know, mystique around celebrities is gone, but then it wasn't. So
I mean, people want to believe that celebrities are our royalty and that they're not, you know, they don't have the same base urges that the rest of us do, but they do, you know, and they're not better than us. They're exactly like us. And it's a mistake to assume that because someone is a talented entertainer or a brilliant politician or a great author or a great movie producer, that somehow they're incapable of doing horrible things.
Your dad was one of the first people to kind of talk, and he wrote an article in like the 80s about where he talked about the change of coverage for politics, TV politics.
Well, you know, my dad always blamed Theodore White for ruining political coverage. Teddy White was a writer who every 4 years between 1960 and at least 1972, maybe 1976, I'm not 100% sure, wrote a book called The Making of the President. But The Making of the President in 1960 read like a novel. And it was the first political coverage that was widely read that got into the personalities and sort of day-to-day private lives of candidates in a way that other journalism at the time did not. So you would see in that book John Kennedy getting on his campaign plane and, you know, frantically trying to eat some tomato soup, you know, before the next before the next campaign event because he was hungry because it had been a long day. That kind of little detail almost never made it into political coverage before that. And so my dad always thought that that TV political coverage, well, I guess all political coverage was changed in part by this desire to see politics as a contest of people and personalities as opposed to a contest of ideas and policy. Mm. And so the result was it got less dry and you learned a lot more about the people, who they were and how, what they liked doing on their days off. But you learned less because it's a zero-sum game. Mm. You learned less about what your life was going to be like if they became president. That's still true.
Mm-hmm.
And every presidential campaign is now filled with the coverage of trivial ancillary issues.
What's your hope for the future of TV reporting, TV politics? You know, what's your hope? What's your thought about where this is going without kind of getting into sort of the Trump era, although it's hard to avoid that in terms of how this has affected how the coverage is, but
you know, it's discouraging to have a president who calls the press the enemy of the country because in fact, we're not, we're a vital part of this country and we're a vital part of people understanding how they make the choices that they make. Mm-hmm. You would not know about President Trump or about any of the things that he's for if it weren't for the fact that we have a free press. But leaving that aside, there have never been fewer barriers to entry into journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when I started, I mean, if you wanted an audition tape, you had to persuade somebody who had a TV camera to shoot it for you. Now, you know, you can shoot the whole story on your iPhone and edit it and send it out to anybody you want, and that might get you a job. Mm-hmm. And you don't need anybody's help. That's great. You know, that makes it possible for all kinds of people to get into this business as opposed to, well, you have to know somebody and you have to set up the right interviews. And first, you're going to have to work in Saginaw. And then if you're lucky, you know, you can get another job in Richmond. And then after that, maybe you can come to Washington, D.C. Well, it's people don't have to wait as long. And anybody can become a journalist. Now, that said, one of the great advantages over other news organizations that places like ABC, CBS, and NBC have is that we have a set of standards and ethics that's written down that if you don't follow it, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. Guy got suspended at ABC the other day for being wrong about a detail in the Kobe Bryant story.
How does Fox get away with that?
Well, I mean, they clearly don't have the same standards book that the rest of us do. They have a different agenda, which I think is pretty clear if you watch it. But I mean, you know, if I get enough stuff wrong, or something serious wrong, I could get suspended or fired. Anybody could. But a lot of the online journalism, some of which is extremely reputable, some of which is extremely good, you have to figure out for yourself what the difference between this website, which is a real news organization, and this one, which isn't, is. You have to figure out what the difference between those two things is going to be and how it's going to, how it impacts the veracity of what you're reading. And that's a lot harder to do than it used to because, you know, there's so many more places where you can get your news. Some of them are giving you the straight story. Some of them are not. And a lot of the time, it's tough to decide which is and which isn't.
If people don't want to determine that, though, because I think one of the things, too, that I find frustrating, I call it the Rotten Tomato effect, which is, I mean, I think it's great what you're saying is that there is more accessibility to journalism. But as someone who's worked in the movie, with movies for so long and went and got, you know, degrees to be able to do this, there's a million people who say they're a film critic. There's a million people who say they're a restaurant critic. I mean, everybody, South Park famously spoofed it. You know, everybody's a Yelp restaurateur. Right. And, you know, so, and there's tons of people out there who say they're journalists. And is, I guess that's, you know, how's this all going to play out? I wish, I mean, I'm not saying you have the answer. But.
I don't have the answer. And that's a real question. I mean, yeah, you can, I mean, there's no license. Anybody can be a reporter. Anybody can call themselves a reporter. How accurate they are, how fair they are, how the degree to which they put their own feelings aside when they're doing a story. Those are things you'll never know. Mm-hmm. Unless you read or watch their work over time. That's the problem. But the first time you read it, you're not going to know.
The hope I have is that folks like you and your colleagues have been doing it for a long time, and you have standards and you have credibility, and you're doing storytelling.
Right.
But you're also, you know, I have faith and trust in what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's true. And I think I'm not alone with that.
Well, I hope you're not. No, I think that's great. I mean, I think I, you know, look, I, you know, it's, you know, there were people when I got into this business that I had a lot of faith and trust in that I, some of them are still working and I continue to have faith and trust in them. I think that, you know, as I've gotten older, I think that is more important than I used to think mm-hmm. at the time. But you know, people who play fast and loose with the facts generally get found out. Not all the time, but generally.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave this. Thank you very much for your time, Josh.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And for those of you wanting to know when your next story is coming on Dateline.
Well, I
Dateline?
Have a story that's going to be, it's going to be ready by this Friday, the 7th of February, but I don't think it's going to run this Friday. I think it's going to run either the 14th or the 21st or the 28th.
Okay.
And it has to do with some other things that are in the editing process right now. I think I need to tell one last story. And give you total credit.
Okay.
Which is when I met my wife, which is a story that many people know, but some don't know. We were in the TSA line at LAX. And were it not for the fact that she couldn't leave because you're in line and you can't go anywhere, she probably would not have stayed and listened to me talk for 20 minutes. And parenthetically, now after we're married and I start talking, there's a good chance that if I talk for 20 minutes, she won't be in the room anymore. But at the time, there was no getting away from me because we were trapped in this line. And this was before TSA pre-check and clear. So it was extremely long, slow line. And I talked to her for a while, and then I gave her my card. And I was kind of hoping that she would call me and maybe we could go out. But I also did not harbor any realistic hope that was going to happen because she was kind of out of my league. And apparently, I didn't find this out until somewhat later, she went to Las Vegas where she encountered, among other people, you, mm-hmm. and you were already friends with her.
Yeah.
And somehow the topic came around to Dateline, and my wife said, "Oh, that's weird. I met somebody from Dateline today." And you said, "Well, you met somebody? Who?" And T said, "I don't know, Josh somebody." And you said, "You met Josh Mankiewicz?
Yeah.
You got to call him." That's why she did. That's
boom.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I owe you. I always will.
Yeah, she, I remember being so, because I've been a fan for a long time. I've been a fan of Dateline. And so when she said this, and I want to say it was 2009, it was like, who's this guy? What? I remember just being stunned. Like, Josh Mankiewicz, you got to call him. Call him right now.
Yeah. Well, she did. She called me.
Yes. I'm very happy to be the reason why you're married.
You are. You absolutely are.
Well, thanks, Josh. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And as of course, go to NBC Dateline's website, which I believe is just Dateline.
You can get it on the NBCNews.com website. Right. There's a tab on that, which will take you right there.
And you can follow the stories. And I believe you have a podcast now?
We have podcasts that are the audio of of Dateline shows, which you can get wherever you get your podcast. There's also a great podcast by Keith Morrison called The Thing About Pam.
I follow
which
it,
is
yes.
so wonderful. Yeah. And Keith is so great at that. And then I'm also doing a podcast, which I don't know the title of, but it'll probably come out in April.
Great. Oh, and I would be, I will kick myself if I don't ask what you think of Bill Hader's impression of you.
Who wouldn't love that? I mean, what can I mean, if I ever meet him, I'll shake his hand. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Visit the HMC Network for more episodes of Conversations and other great podcasts. And to sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an update.